Everyone, you've tuned into Paradigm Shifters, and boy, Paradigm Shifters is a series of talks with people who are making a difference on the collective at this time. And tonight we have a very, very delightful guest and his personality cohort. We have Steve Behrman and his cohort, Swami Beyond Ananda, and they're going to take us through some spontaneous evolution, which is the name of the book that Steve and Bruce Lipton wrote. But really, we're going to talk about evolution and maybe get some done. Will we, Steve? Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
It's wonderful to be here with you, and I love this book. I'm quite delighted, and I want to know how to evolve quickly. Can you tell everybody that?
Well, you know, interestingly, the Swami was doing a performance just the other night in Santa Rosa at a conference. And in fact, I'll channel Swami to give you his answer. And someone asked him, Swami, how can I achieve enlightenment immediately? And the Swami said, well, go wear dark clothes and stand out on the internet, on the interstate at night. So Matt, that's the very, very, very quick form. For the rest of us, I think that as we're probably noticing, so many things in our society seem to be melting down, breaking down, falling apart, and so on. And this may sound a bit perverse, but it's actually a good sign, because mm-hmm. it means that the old organism, the caterpillar organism, is falling apart, as is the natural thing for it to do, because it's no longer useful. And the good news is there is a butterfly organism being born. And we human
beings... So exciting.
Yes. And mm-hmm. and so you perhaps have heard of Paul Ray, who wrote the book called The Cultural Creatives.
Yes, I read some of it.
Mm-hmm.
I read some of it.
Yes, and he said that there's now about 70 million adult Americans, about 35% of our population, who essentially get that we are all connected, that the what's good for ourselves is good for our body, is good for our community, is good for humanity, and it is good for the planet. And what Bruce Lipton and I have written about in Spontaneous Evolution is that there is a new exciting chapter in human evolution that is we are right on the cusp of, and that mm-hmm. is where we recognize that we are each and all cells in a new organism called humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And this, as with every other process of evolution, every other phase of evolution from the time that we were single-cell organisms and decided we were tired of being single and wanted to combine with other cells in order to create more efficiency, awareness, and community about 700 million years ago, there's been a process ever since of evolution, which has meant increased awareness and increased community, so that each of us and everybody listening, we're all communities of upward of 50 trillion cells.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? The cells are all cooperating. I mean, yeah, we got some bad cells here and there, but in a healthy individual, the entire system is so robust that primarily the cells are working together. And we have under our skins, in our community under our skins, we have full employment, we have universal health care, we have no cell left behind. And the organs are actually working together cooperatively, unlike the nations of the world that seem to be in competition and fighting with one another. And you never hear about the liver invading the pancreas demanding the islets of Langerhans. So our cells may be more evolved than we are at this point, but we are catching up.
So what you're saying is the remember the last time you were on was right around the big election time, and you had some pretty powerful political statements to make. So I'm chuckling going, yeah, well, so our politics tonight is really about what recognizing the evolution of the species and the coming apart of these systems. It's a different kind of politics, isn't it?
Well, you know, there, it's interesting that you mentioned the election because there are a lot of people who are disappointed that Obama hasn't done more and so on. And what we have to recognize is that the caterpillar is not fixable. The job is not to fix the caterpillar, but to build a butterfly. And so Obama is still the CEO of the American empire. And as such, he's taking his orders from the board of directors, which happen to be the bankers, the big pharmacy, the oil companies, et cetera, et cetera. And so we are now looking at this old political system, which is based on what Bruce Lipton and I call in our book myth perceptions. These are beliefs taken to be true but have now been disproved by science. And we're still living by these burned-out stars. We're still living by these beliefs that no longer are true. And so consequently, the institutions that we have built, the structures that we have built, that tend to be self-perpetuating structures, that are not really serving the commonwealth, but are unfortunately serving the uncommonly wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so during this evolutionary, as we call it, evolutionary uprising, because we are waking up and we are wising up, during this uprising, we are coming to recognize that we have to be the leaders that we've been waiting for. We can't expect a top-down, some savior coming out of the sky and making everything right, that we individual cells in the body of this new organism called humanity, we need to awaken, we need to connect with one another, and we need to act in concert as if we all are all cells in one body.
Mm-hmm. And so how do we do that? What do you recommend?
Well, first of all, we are going to look at perhaps the 12-step program for recovering from civilization, but maybe we need a 3-step program because there's no time for 12.
That's right. There isn't.
Okay,
yet.
So very, very simple 3-step program. Step number one is awareness. To become aware, the first two sections of spontaneous evolution, part one is called What If Everything You Know Is Wrong? And we postulate that so much of what we accept as reality are really beliefs. And we're not even conscious that we believe them. They're invisible to us, like air is to birds and water is to fish. We don't really see these beliefs that we're swimming around in. They're beliefs.
But if we share them, then we pass them on, don't we?
Exactly. We pass them on. Many of these beliefs are passed on non-verbally. And some of them are passed on in the uterus from our mother's chemistry in response to her perceptions of the environment. If an expecting mother perceives the environment as threatening and dangerous, then the fetus will be developing more hindbrain, more survival skills, more fight or flight mechanisms. If the mother's blood chemistry is indicating that the world is not a bad place, that it's a friendly place, then we build more frontal cortex. We give ourselves more opportunity for creativity.
Hmm.
So many of these beliefs, they're not even verbalized. They're merely fearful impulses that are passed down from generation to generation.
But you're saying that they actually form how the brain is going to function, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we're born, between the ages of 0 and 6, we are in what's called a hypnagogic state. We are in the same, the brain waves of a child under 6 is very similar to the brain waves of an adult who is under hypnosis. So we are highly suggestible, and since there's so much cranial real estate available when we're young, these initial beliefs that get implanted are very strong and very powerful, and these are some of the basic conclusions or preclusions we make about the nature of life. And so, you know, so many people, and we've all had this experience where we read the books, we do the affirmations, we go to the workshops, we consciously want to improve and have our lives be different, but we find that we tend to repeat the same patterns over and over again. And that has to do with so much of who we are is based on unconscious programming. And so once we begin to awaken to that, that's the step one. That's awareness. We become aware that, number one, that we've been programmed, and number two, that many of these programs are inaccurate. And we begin to examine that. And we begin to reflect that so many people, the one thing that we have in common with other people is that we've all been subject to this kind of programming. And it makes it easier to forgive people. It makes it it makes it easier to forgive because we understand that we've all been programmed and we are not to blame, and yet we are responsible, if that makes any sense.
Yes, it does. So I just want to go back just for a minute to what you said about Obama and people being disappointed. I go, well, he's actually the CEO of a belief structure, isn't he?
Yes, exactly. And we don't know.
And as such, he's relatively limited, isn't he? I mean,
you know, exactly.
He can't live in that.
Because the change in society is really contingent on a critical mass of people being willing to move from the set of beliefs that we have, this belief in materialism primarily, and belief in survival of the fittest, and belief in Newtonian medicine, in the mm-hmm. belief that evolution and life is just a random process, and the way we got here is the same way that the works of Shakespeare could be produced by an infinite number of monkeys typing on an infinite number of typewriters for an infinite amount of time.
Mm.
And, you know, in fact, in part two of the book called The Four Misperceptions of the Apocalypse, we take a look at four pillars of scientific materialism, and lo and behold, they've all been disproved by science, very inconveniently. The idea that the material world is all that exists, well, quantum physics has kind of blown that apart, because at the root of, at the subatomic level of all material, of all matter, there's nothing but energy. So this solid table that I'm pounding my fist on right now, it's really energy. And the reason why I can't put my hand through this table is the same reason that we are not able to drive through a tornado, because the energy vortex is so powerful that forces that try to move through it get repelled, very much like iron filings arrange themselves on a magnetic pattern around a magnet.
Mm.
So really, it's not the matter, it's the field. It's the field, as Einstein said, that is the sole governing factor over the material.
And is that so about our beliefs? Is that what we see?
Well, the field consists of a number of things. You know, it's energy moving, which is a lot like people's definition of spirit. We find that our thoughts can actually impact events, and there have been experiments run by Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Sciences that indicate that by focusing and concentrating, some people, actually all people can, some people can do this very well, can actually influence whether a roll of the dice, whether a coin flipped, rather, comes up heads or tails.
Like, our minds work like the magnetism on the iron filings.
Yes, yes, precisely. Mm-hmm. And just because, you know, we now understand magnetic fields, but imagine, the experiment that our science teachers did when we were in the sixth grade, and the science teacher threw some iron filings on a piece of paper, and they spread themselves out in some form of random process. And then the science teacher slipped a magnet underneath the paper, and lo and behold, when the iron filings are dropped, they arrange themselves in the pattern of the magnet. Now, if we did not know anything about magnetic force and we didn't see the magnet underneath a piece of paper, we would think that these iron filings were extremely intelligent and obedient to be able to organize themselves in that way. So in a similar way, there are very likely forces that we cannot see and have not yet been able to measure accurately, but we do see their results. As an example, probably a lot of people listening to this show, either this has happened to you or you know someone, where at an instant that a loved one was in trouble, you got the message. Or these moments where you know who's going to call and then the telephone rings.
Right.
Because modern science doesn't really have an explanation for these phenomena are ignored. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an underlying pattern. And this underlying pattern can very well have something to do with our thoughts and our intentions.
So when you said a while ago that we are all doing the workshops and this and that and so on, and you were implying that some of the beliefs that we developed or evolved or accrued, if you will, from being a child could still limit us.
Yes.
It's been pretty hard for a lot of people to actually cut through and change all that, isn't it?
Well, yes. And first of all, I think it's important to recognize that, as Bruce Lipton pointed out in his first book, Biology of Belief, that the conscious mind, it handles only 5% of our processes, and the rest is done by the subconscious mind, which is a 50 million bit per minute processor. And so often our conscious mind, is dealing with these surface issues. We're looking at, we're reading a book and we go, that is really a nice idea. But unless we're able to develop the kind of mindfulness and focus to constantly be monitoring our thoughts and so on, it becomes very difficult to make changes in these belief patterns. Now, there are techniques, hypnotherapy, some of the new energy psychology techniques, EFT, Psy-K, et cetera, which are able to find ways to communicate with the subconscious mind and then reprogram the subconscious mind. So we are now discovering that there are ways to do that, and I would expect that in the next number of years, we're going to find these techniques are used to augment the normal kinds of cognitive and talk psychology that we're all familiar with.
Hmm. And do you think that it's the time in the evolution of humanity that these rise into our awareness, and it's going to be easier for us to release the subconscious, and easier because they're programmed to release at this point?
Well, I think that the more people are aware of this, then the more people are working with it, and then it becomes easier for these new beliefs to take hold. I think that there are certain patterns that are ending in this generation. Even if you look at, for example, if you look at patterns of abuse, abuse of children, because of the various 12-step groups, et cetera, there have been patterns of abuse that have continued for generation after generation after generation, and they're stopping. in this generation. They're not being passed on. Not everywhere, but I'm saying that in certain families, among certain people, they are the last generation in their family to be abused. They're not passing that on to their children. So I think that there is awareness. How's that?
Isn't it exciting?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that we're now at a point where there is a necessity for change, because clearly at this level of organization, with our spending, the kind of resources that we're spending, defending against other healthy cells. You know, it's not just we're not just defending against some enemy, but among our so-called enemies, most of those people are healthy individuals who have been who are caught up in a political structure that either they're not aware of or they can't do much about. So at this point, there is a global awakening taking place, and there are people all across the globe who are becoming these imaginal cells of this new butterfly organism. The cultural creatives that Paul Ray has described, that now are 70 million Americans. When he first started writing about this 10 or 15 years ago, they were 50 million Americans. And at the end of World War II, some 60 years ago, they were hardly a blip on the radar. Mm. That belief structure was very, very rare. But
how many does he say there are now? 70 million?
70 million.
Okay.
So it's up from 50 million in 1999 when he wrote the Cultural Creatives book. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is that this is the belief system that is now magnetizing more people on the planet. Now, it's not everybody. There are many traditional cultures. You know, it's not the Taliban are not cultural creatives. But what's happening is that many traditional people are skipping the scientific modern phase and going right to the heart-based cultural creative mindset of our being connected with spirit, connected with the planet, and connected with one another.
But you know something, Steve? I think also it's true that perhaps even in the Taliban and perhaps even in the Pentagon and perhaps even there are people being struck with it as well, right?
Yes, there's, and lightning is striking everywhere. People are getting struck by enlightening everywhere. And that's very true.
Mm. And so it's not a matter of like when we have defenses against certain kinds of people, it really isn't like that anymore in certain ways. Certain people are going to unfold all around us and I think surprise themselves. That's maybe how the system is going to dissolve, do you think?
Well, you know, there's an interesting story that Patricia Sun, the spiritual psychologist, tells. It's something that happened about 15 years ago. And she was speaking at a New Age bookstore somewhere, and as she arrived, there were four fundamentalist Christian pickets outside who were picketing her appearance. And she said to the bookstore owner, "I'm going to go talk with those people." And the owner says, "Well, really, you can't talk with those people." But she went anyway. And after about 10 minutes of conversation, three of the four picketers put down their picket signs, hugged her, and said, "What you're saying is exactly what Jesus says." And the fourth one kept walking around with his picket sign. So that would indicate that three out of four people are susceptible to love and respect.
Mm-hmm.
And so when love and respect are present, people's fear-based beliefs and defenses can break down, and that's not true of everybody, but it's certainly true of a vast majority of us. And so we have a mainstream media that either unintentionally or intentionally creates so much conflict that people remain polarized and they don't compare notes, they don't speak with one another, they stay separated, and we have the completely absurd situation in the United States. We have the red tribe Republicans and the blue tribe Democrats arguing about whether it's worse to kill the born or the unborn. You know, it makes no sense. when in actuality there are virtues and values that the vast majority of us share in common. And now is the time for the new imaginal self to begin to cohere around these virtues and values and to transcend these polarities of left and right, of progressive and conservative, of masculine and feminine, of spirit and matter, all of these dichotomies.
Of rich and poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of these, and what we talk about in Spontaneous Evolution and in part three of the book, which is really the solutions and future pace, it's called Changing the Garden, Regrowing the Garden. Part of this new story involves integrating opposites, turning dueling dualities into dynamic duos and dance partners. So instead of devolving into positions like progressive and conservative, it's much more useful for us to ask as communities, how do we wish to progress and what do we want to conserve?
That's you're making me think here.
Yeah, I know. As somebody once said, you know, as Swami says, you know, I know what you're thinking. I am proposing a sane world. I must be crazy. You know, so.
Well, so there's a line in here that says changing of the God. And I think that's such a Swami line, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the changing of the gods is essentially the changing of the belief systems that are determining what we think reality is. You know, several centuries ago, the predominant belief system was monotheism, that basically there was an infallible God and an infallible church, and we're going to heaven and you can go to hell if you don't like that, and many people were sent on their way. And then we had, you know, the cracks in the wall, the crack in the infallibility came when Copernicus, in the early 1500s, he was a scientist, an astrologer, and he was given the job of trying to reconcile the solar and lunar calendars because the church wanted to take all of these formerly pagan holidays and integrate them into the church calendar so that they could become saints' days. And so they hired, they assigned this job to Copernicus. So when Copernicus tried to resolve the solar and lunar calendars using the prevailing belief that the sun revolved around the earth, he was unable to do it. But when he followed his own intuition and suspicion and did the calculations as if the earth revolved around the sun, all of the calculations calculated. So this was kind of an inconvenient truth. The good news is I've got your calendars to reconcile, and the bad news is I'm not going to tell you because you're not going to like it. And so 100 years after Copernicus made this discovery, Galileo was still in prison for saying that the Earth revolved around the sun. So these beliefs take a long time sometimes to...
And wasn't Copernicus spurned and isolated from society?
No. Copernicus, he published his results on his deathbed, and some would have said, well, any day that he published it would have been his deathbed. But no, he waited until he was ready to die, and then he published his results.
He says, aha!
Aha, yes. And so that was the first, that was in 1543, and really just a few years later was when Martin Luther, who was upset that the church was selling get-out-of-hell-free cards called indulgences, nailed his 95 theses to the wall, and we had the Protestant Reformation. And from there we had Descartes and Newton and Sir Francis Bacon in the beginning of science, where over a period of a couple of centuries, the prevailing belief went from God has control over everything to the universe is a machine, And that's the prevailing belief today. But you know what? It's not exactly true. And scientists are finding out that, you know, what the ancient spiritual teachers have been teaching, the notion that we're really all connected and entangled, and that the golden rule makes sense because, you know, we want to treat the others like ourselves because there really is no difference. And so we're finding, science is now finding and proving, that what the ancient spiritual teachers said was absolutely correct. You know, Einstein discovered that we're all related. Evolutionary scientists and biological scientists are finding out that it's not survival of the fittest, it's thrival of the fittingest, that organisms evolve as part of an environment. And those organisms that fit the environment are more likely to survive. So, you know, while we're so busy competing with one another to be the fittest individual, we've been neglecting to recognize that our fitness as a species is really up for question.
That's interesting. Tell me this. Do you know historically where the golden rule comes from? Is it as far back as we have any recorded history?
Well, you know what? I believe that even the Sumerians had a version of it. In the spontaneous evolution, we look at, I think it's 10 or 12 different religions, and their representations of the golden rule. That's why we're calling it the one suggestion, because it's the suggestion that seems to be at the bottom of just about every spiritual path. And let's see if I can find the earliest one here, but this will give you kind of an idea of, let's see, we have it in Zoroastrianism, that nature alone is good, which refrains from doing another whatsoever is not good for itself. We have Buddhism, hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful. In Confucianism, do not do unto others what you would not like yourself. Then there will be no resentment against you either in the family or in the state. In Judaism, what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow man. This is the entire law. All the rest is commentary. Are we starting to get a hint here that maybe at the bottom of every one of these religions is really the same coaching, the same principle, the same...
Well, it's also a belief. I mean, it is kind of like a really deep bottom-of-the-pile belief that we all seem to share at some level, huh?
Well, see, the thing is that, again, the golden rule tends to be the belief in our conscious mind. But the programming that we've had through 5,000 years at least of dominating one another is fear-based, lowest common denominator programming, that it's me or you. So I would suggest that even though most people listening would say, yes, I think the golden rule is great, and I try to live by the golden rule, I don't really believe in this dog-eat-dog-rat race, nonetheless, when push comes to shove, we tend to push and shove because this programming is so deep. And I find that even, you know, people who are working for peace and justice and social change and environmental change, many people really, really deep down don't believe that that change is actually possible.
Yeah, I've heard that a number of times. And that's because we have those old lines like, 'twas ever thus, history always repeats itself, you got to watch out for number one, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that all the same principle?
And we see this in our society. A friend of mine retired from the military, and she was looking for a job, and she got a job offer from this company who was essentially producing false propaganda.
Oh,
and she turned the job down. And her friends treated her like she was some kind of a leper. They said, how could you turn that job down? What are you, some kind of idiot? And the rationale is, if you don't do it, somebody else will. So we have this kind of cynicism, which is based on not having a central trans-religious human moral authority, even though most human beings would live by the golden rule.
Mm-hmm.
But because
I think it's very interesting in your book, you talked about how interesting dog eat dog is a term that we use. We'll talk about that a little bit. But
well, first of all, dogs don't eat dogs.
Right.
Dogs bark at dogs. Dogs eat squirrels. But in general, inside of a pack of dogs, you'll have an alpha dog and submissive dogs, and they'll deal with the status issues inside the pack. But the law of the jungle, the so-called law of the jungle, it doesn't even apply in the jungle, because the lion is not going after the fastest gazelle so he could have a trophy to mount on his den wall. He's going after the weakest gazelle. So really, it's the law of the jungle is really the non-survival of the non-fittest. So all of this competition, we're trying to compete with each other. It sort of reminds me of the two hunters who are in the woods and they see this very hungry bear. And one of them starts running, and the other one says, "Why are you running? You're never going to be able to outrun the bear." And the other one says, "I'm not trying to outrun the bear. You know, the bear's only going to get one of us. It ain't going to be me." So, so he didn't want to be the weakest of the gazelles. Okay. So the point is that so much of the competition that we engage in is totally unnecessary, and that the nature of nature is symbiotic and cooperative.
Because if we really are ourselves, there's really no competition for us anyway, is there?
Well, yeah. It's like Oscar Wilde said, "Be yourself, everybody else is taken." Or Swami says, "Each of us is totally unique, just like everybody else." so we have this, we are each, totally unique cells in the organism called humanity. And, that's not like, my God, we're all automatons, we're all these mindless cells in this one body. No, because of our individual consciousness and because of our individuality, our individual personalities, the things that we know, the things that we've learned, our experiences, the things that we love, our gifts and skills, we are totally unique. And maybe we're here to be a totally unique expression of that, and maybe the best way for that to happen is in a community of thriving human cells where we're not wasting our energy competing with or trying to kill one another.
Or defending.
Yeah. And really, in the body, the body has an immune system, so that when we do have sociopathogens, we do have something that's in the body that's harmful, the immune system is the police force that is sent in to manage that particular criminal situation. But it doesn't, unless we have a severe autoimmune dysfunction, we're not attacking healthy cells. We're not attacking our own healthy cells.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's very significant. What if we liberated the trillions of dollars that we spend defending ourselves? What if we liberated that money and used it to regrow the garden, to build a healthier world, where we wouldn't need to create that much defense?
So if the systems are coming apart, how is that going to be? How is that going to look? How do we stand in support of that?
Of things coming apart?
Yeah.
I think that first of all, the way to mitigate things coming apart is to put together something that's healthy. Mm-hmm. So there are some very exciting movements going on locally. One is the Transition Town movement, where local communities are coming together to create sustainable business, local economy, local energy and food independence. Very important. If you have your own food as a community, as a region, and if you're able to harness the infinite energy of the sun and renewable energies of that sort, then you're safe and you're solid, and you can build on that wealth. You know, there was an economist back in the 30s, Carl Wilken, who said that all new wealth comes from the soil. Every year, new wealth in the form of food pops out of the ground. And it's relentless. It happens. It's like manna that comes from the ground. It's like loaves and fishes. And so Wilken's very simple idea was to make sure that farmers were paid a fair price for the food they produce, and then they would have the money to buy things, then that would fuel the economy all the way through. It would multiply. He figured that in the 1930s, the national income was 7 times what the farm income was. And he figured that out over many years that was the case. Now, during the Depression, the farm income was 1/2 of what it had been in the year before the Depression started. And yet, the same amount of food was grown. So did the food have half the calories?
No.
So the money is simply a representation of wealth. It's not in and of itself wealth. So in this economic collapse that we're experiencing right now, we need to redefine for ourselves, for our communities, and for our world, what is really wealth. Wealth is food. Wealth is energy. Wealth is love. Wealth is community. Wealth is imagination.
And air.
Yes. Yes. Well, we got to breathe, that's for sure. Breathing is the key to long life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, if we breathe in, we inspire, and when we don't, we expire.
Very good.
Now keep breathing.
So let's talk about health and the health care battle that's going on.
Well, I'll tell you something about that. We don't need a health care system. We need a healthy caring system.
That's right. Thank you.
Yes, and you know what? We need more patience with our patients. We have inpatient care right now. You get to see the doctor for 15 seconds and then move on. And the drug companies, I'm telling you, the drug companies, they are actually creating new illnesses so that they can sell drugs. Like restless leg syndrome. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Listen, why didn't they do what they did in the old days? Just get a helper humping dog, that's all. You don't need drugs. But seriously, the healthcare system is very top-heavy, and there's so many factors. I mean, certainly there's a profit factor, but there's also the factor of high-intervention medicine. And we being so used to paying for high-intervention medicine, when in 80% of the cases, low-intervention, low-cost, non-invasive medicine does the trick. And then the cases where you do need surgery, you do need drugs, you do need these really expensive procedures, then we can proceed with those. The other factor in our healthcare system is that being in this materialist belief system, we really have a very poor understanding of death as a part of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so doctors, either they themselves feel or they've been pushed into the position of somehow fighting against death in all cases, even when the individual is really, when all their systems are shutting down and they're ready to leave. And so it's quite often that people in these end stages need to be in hospice care, and instead they're getting high intervention, very expensive medicine, very expensive surgery, and procedures that are really very hardly work at all, but it's all the medical establishment knows how to do. I had somebody call me a number of years ago about a relative of theirs who, you know, had a pancreatic cancer, you know, really end stage. And they wanted to give her chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy had a 10% chance of working.
10%.
10%. Or a 90% chance of not working. Okay?
Mm.
So anyway, 10% chance of working. So we recommended this Chinese oriental medicine practitioner who is very good in that region. She went to this OMD. She came back with an armful of herbs. And her MD said, don't take those herbs. You can't take that. It'll interfere with the chemo. That has a 10% chance of being successful. That's the level of insanity. We've bought into that belief system, and that's one of the things that makes medicine so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our bodies, we do have a no-cell left-behind universal health care. The cells in our bodies all get what they need to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do so much better as a society if we recognized that children and all of us need what we, you know, we all need to thrive. And in thriving, we will make a contribution. We will make the world a better place. We will add to the commonwealth. We will add to happiness in the world. And there are certain societies where, like Bhutan, where they measure the gross national happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, well, you know what happens in this country. People are afraid that somebody might be happier than they are. And Freud called this happiness envy.
That's absolutely right. So where do we go? We had two steps, but we didn't do the third one, I think.
Okay, well, first step is awareness. Second step is intention and choice. We have a choice. We can choose whether we feed the wolf of love or the wolf of fear. We can choose whether we adhere to these obsolete beliefs of dominate or be dominated, or whether we take the risk and join the we're all in this together belief world. Having made those, having had awareness and having set an intention, then the next piece is the practical action that we take. In knowing that we are all cells in the body of humanity, how do we behave differently? What kind of work do we do? How do we weave our work and mission with the society at large, with the new butterfly organism? How do we participate in growing this new butterfly organism? What do we tell our kids? What do we tell our grandkids? How do we communicate in the world? How do we, in ourselves, dismantle the programming that has kept us from being who we are meant to be?
Exactly. It's a really crucial question. All of them are.
Yeah. And I think, first of all, the first step in deprogramming is awareness.
Mm-hmm.
If you're aware that you've been programmed, then that is a huge first step. If you're aware that, you know, these things that I've taken for granted as reality are really just beliefs. Here's an example. You know, we imagine that, you know, we are physical beings and it's the physiology and you got to take something that's chemical. If you have a disease, you got to take something that's chemical. Well, in drug trials, one of the most exasperating things about drug trials is that often a new drug will work 40% of the time, but the placebo effect will work 35% of the time. In other words, giving a patient something that's merely a sugar pill and telling them that it's a cure, somehow, in 35% of the cases, the people get cured anyway. Isn't that curious? And so here's science trying to figure out how to eliminate the placebo effect, how to factor it out, when in fact we should all be learning how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, it sort of reminds me, and you were talking earlier about the field, and everything is the field. And it is just influencing the field that sometimes triggers a complete change in physical problems, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, how is it that spontaneous remissions take place?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Lewis Mill Madrona, who has worked with Dr. Andrew Weil, has done some extensive studies on what factors are present, what factors are the common denominator in these spontaneous remissions. Somebody has a disease, and then 2 weeks later there's no sign of it, and the medical establishment is baffled, and then they try to insist this individual didn't have the disease in the first place.
Right.
So what happens? Well, what Dr. Mel Madrona discovered is that very often there is a profound change in belief that precedes the spontaneous remission. A change in belief, a change in behavior. Sometimes it's letting go of a job. Sometimes it's letting go of a worry. Sometimes it's letting go of a relationship. Sometimes it's moving to another physical place. But there's always a profound change in belief and or behavior that accompanies or precedes the spontaneous remission. So it's not something that comes out of the sky and you're lucky enough to get struck by lightning. There is actually a conscious change, a decision perhaps, a choice. You know, first there's an awareness, then there's a choice, and then there's something different in action that takes place, and then the person doesn't have the disease. I have a friend who was, about 5 or 6 years ago, was diagnosed with leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she started going through the regular kinds of treatments and so on, and she felt her energy just draining. And then one day, she had this epiphany, and she decided that she wanted to live. She realized she had a choice. And she just stepped into, I want to live. And so she began to investigate the things that she could do to enhance her her body's balance, and she's been symptom-free for the last 5 years, doing just
Yay.
Fine. So in her case, it was based on the decision and then the actions that were taken on the basis of that decision.
Now, about some of the actions, your wife, and I think it started with Bruce Lipton, there's a Psych-K kind of thing, and then there's EFT and that sort of thing. Isn't that based on the way of using, of shifting the fields in people, shifting energy and releasing blocked energy flow?
Yes. I've had extensive experience with Psyche. My wife has been a Psyche facilitator. And it's a very useful tool to identify limiting beliefs, and through the use of a certain way of communicating with the body and putting the body in a whole brain pose and so on, you're able to reinstall, you're able to install new beliefs. What we've found is that once these new beliefs are installed, then you actually have to start using the new program.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, like a program on your computer, you can install a program, but what if you never use it?
Right.
So the new program.
So you actually have to act differently, think differently.
And you have to just begin to practice it, something mm-hmm. different. If I'm this way and not that way, then how do I behave?
So that returned us back to the that part of having intention and choice, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's not, you know, this is a, this evolution that we're going through right now, this is a conscious participation. And, you know, religious monotheism has told us that we're victims of a wrathful God. Scientific materialism tells us that we're victims of a random universe. It turns out that beyond the victims and villains are conscious co-creators. We are conscious co-creators. As the Swami would say, we are the creator's creation created to create, so let's go for heaven on earth just for the hell of it.
Well, I just love this book, and I recommend to everyone listening, Spontaneous Evolution. our positive future and a way to get there from here by Bruce Lipton and Steve Behrman. And, of course, Swami's had a bit to do with it too, right?
Well, you know, right at the outset, we wanted the Swami to provide comic relief, and so the Swami has comically relieved himself all through the pages. Every chapter begins with a Swami quote.
Well, and we're being called to a close here, and I've so enjoyed our time, Steve, and certainly hope that you will come back and bring your friend Swami with you.
And thanks, Veronica, and I know that it's on the website, on your website, but our website is wakeuplaughing.com. You can find out more about spontaneous evolution there, find out more about the Swami, and we have a Wake Up Laughing ebook that we're working with that's going to be out very shortly, so send us an email and we'll tell you about it.
And I love the idea of waking up laughing all the time anyway, so wakeuplaughing.com, and thank you. We'll talk again, I hope.
Thanks so much, and may the farce be with you.
And
thanks,
you too.
Veronica.
Many blessings. So this is Veronica Entwistle. It was wonderful having Steve Behrman, one of the co-writers of Spontaneous Evolution. I really recommend it. I'll see you on Thursday night. We'll be talking about evolution on Radiance by Design at 7 o'clock and meeting with Jackie Salvitti and the team on ET Healing and Explorations in Consciousness at 8 o'clock. Many blessings. If any of you would like a session with me, like to talk to me, recommend other visitors or guests, or make a comment, Veronica@VeronicaEntwistle.com, Veronica@VeronicaEntwistle, no H in Entwistle.com. And again, thank you so much for listening. Many blessings to all of you. Good night.